Well, thanks for having me here tonight. In fact, I think our school is actually in the spring break, so it is almost impossible for me to get my student to come. So I'm so happy to see many of you here. And so thanks for coming. Well, I think the talk that I'm going to give tonight is actually about China's third world policy from the Maoist era to the present day. What I'm going to do is actually trying to focus on the continuity and change of China's foreign policy towards the third world country, especially those developing countries in Latin America, South Asia, Africa, and also Central Asia as well. So what I'm going to do is basically I'm trying to use two different approaches. One is actually a chronological approach to give you a historical overview of China's foreign policy in relations to the third world from 1950 onwards up to the current moment. And then I'm going to use a regional case study approach, trying to reveal some of the main issue in China's expansion into Southeast Asia, Central Asia, Africa, Latin America, and also some other part of the world. So it is an interesting combination of historical timeline and also a regional case study approach. And after the presentation, then maybe we can have a Q&A. So if there's any issue or any questions that you want to ask me, then maybe we can actually have a much more in-depth discussion afterward. I think before I speak, I just want to make sure everyone of you got a copy of the map. Because I think the number of countries that I'm going to mention in the talk, so if you had a map, then I think that would be wonderful. And also, whenever we look at China's foreign policy, geography is also a very important issue as well. So once we have a map, I think that makes it much easier to understand the geopolitical and also the geostrategic dimensions of China's expansion into the third world. Okay, before I start, I just want to draw your attention to this week's issues of The Economist. I just got that this morning, actually. I just find that very funny. The front page is actually The New Colonialists. And I think they had a very special report on China, especially the Chinese expansion into the Central Asia and Middle East. Well, the funny thing is, I think in the 21st century, if you're going to be a colonialist, you're not going to rely on camels. You're basically trying to travel by SUV and also some other modern transportation. But it is a very interesting discourse about how important China has become within the Western mass media today. And I think in this in the special report, you also see a very interesting representations of China about how China is going to eat up the world's resources. So it's interesting to see that kind of stereotype within the Western mainstream media. But having said that, I think if you have time, maybe you would like to just take a look at this special issue of The Economist and try to get a sense of how the rise of China. Okay, how the emergence of China's power in the church in the 21st century has been represented in this important magazine. Okay, let me get back to my talk, which is about China's third world policy from the Maoist era to the present day. At the end of last year, there were two major issues that actually captured our attention, in New York. One is actually about the human rights abuse in Darfur, in Sudan, and the other is actually the pro-democracy movement in Burma. Now, the interesting thing is, in these two incidents, the West, especially the United States, has put pressure on Beijing and trying to get Beijing to condemn all this human rights abuse in Darfur and also in Burma. But China did not act as what the United States call a responsible international prayer by putting pressure on Darfur and Burma. But still, the international world began to see China as a very important power in the early 20th century. Because, even though we have all this, political issue, regional crisis happening in Burma and also in Sudan, but the international community realized that they need to get China's cooperation in order to achieve, certain international agenda. Now, there are two main arguments I want to make in this talk. The first argument is, when we look at China's foreign policy to the third world, we have to be realistic about China's ability, okay? China did not have the formal power and also the infrastructure to be a first world country, okay, you know, China did not have the formal power, namely the military power and also the economic resources to become a first world country like the United States or the European Union. But China actually had the ability and also the diplomatic mechanism to become a champion of the third world. And I think the political leader in Beijing, they were aware of what they can achieve with their limited resources. So in the November 2006, you know, President Hu Jintao, in an international conference on Sino-African relations, he actually pledged to open up the Chinese market for more than 400 import items from those African countries with diplomatic relationship with Beijing. Okay, so we have to be careful. I mean, only those countries with diplomatic relationship with Beijing. But for those African countries with diplomatic relationship with Taiwan, tend to be excluded from the Chinese, you know, market. So what President Hu Jintao is doing is, you know, he tried to use the Chinese economic influence to counter against or to balance against the United States in the third world, okay, especially in the African continent. In the meantime, we also see the United States is also facing a serious military setback in Iraq and Afghanistan. And also, in the meantime, the United States is also losing its own diplomatic battles against North Korea and Iran over their nuclear weaponry program. So it is actually against this background of balance of power between China and the United States that Beijing began to adopt a much more ambitious and also a much more aggressive policy to expand its influence in the third world. The main purpose is actually trying to counterbalance Washington, D.C. In the third world country. So the second point I want to make is what we are seeing now at the beginning of the 21st century is a very interesting political transformation, or it was a very interesting global transformation. A new global system is now in the making. Okay, a new global system is now in the making, especially after the beginning of the war on terror. Okay, a new global system is now in the making. And I think the world, everything is shifting towards the China's favor. Okay, so right now the leaders in Beijing, they are very keen to maintain a stable international environment for China's economic development. And also they try to avoid provoking any strong responses and reaction from the United States. So what China is doing is, whenever the United States withdraw their influence from the third world, China trying to move in and fill the political vacuum. Okay, so China trying to move in and trying to fill the political vacuum left by the United States in Central Asia, Latin America, South Asia, and Africa. And also at the same time, China also has been very active in making her presence felt in many international organizations, such as the World Health Organization, the Security Councils of the UN, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and also the six-party nuclear talks over the whole subject about North Korea. So a new global system is now in the making. So whatever we are doing nowadays, you know, we have to, you know, read our newspaper, okay, just to try to get a sense of, you know, how the world is going to take shape in the next 10 or 15 years. Now, in this talk, when I use the term third world, I basically refer to all the developing and underdeveloped countries in Central Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Now, during the Cold War, many of these developing countries, they just become independent from their European colonial master after the World War II, and they refuse to be affiliated with the Soviet Union, which is the socialist bloc, and also the NATO, the U.S.-controlled NATO, you know, international alliances. So most of these developing countries, they try to create a new diplomatic fund known as the Third World in order to counterbalance the U.S. and also the Soviet Union influence on a global scale. So it is against this background that it is interesting to see how China adopt a set of new strategy to compete for all this attention from the third world country in, you know, since September 11. And also, how did the third world country understand the rise of Chinese influence on a global scale over the last 10 years. So, in the first part of the talk, I'm going to give you a quick historical review about, you know, the timeline, the chronological development of China's Third World Policy from the Maoist period to the time of President Hu Jintao. And then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to use, as I mentioned, a regional approach and trying to review the Chinese interaction with the Third World country from region to region. Okay, just a little bit of the historical background. After the Communist Revolutions of 1949, the People's Republic of China was actually facing a serious diplomatic isolation imposed by the West. You know, the first incident is actually the Korean War. I think at the time of the Korean War, I think the United States trying to contain the Maoist China in Northeast Asia. Okay, and I think when we look at the whole natures of the Korean War, it was actually a military confrontation between the United States and China on the Korean soil. But the Korean War, as we know, it is a war without winner and loser. Okay, so all the countries that was actually involved, they just get back to that line, the 38 parallel. Okay, they achieved nothing, you know, to be honest. But many people actually lost their life. But anyway, I think the Korean War actually marked the beginning of the Cold War or the Sino-American competitions in the Northeast Asia. Now, it is against the background of the Korean War that China began to see herself as part of the Soviet Union bloc. What happened is, you know, from 1950 to 1957, China actually see herself as a dependent state of the Soviet Union, and she completely identified with the socialist camp that was actually, you know, controlled and also directed by Moscow. But the thing is, this relationship between China and the Soviet Union was not permanent. Okay, it was not a harmonious and stable relationship. It was actually a difficult relationship based on complicated strategic calculations on both sides. It's also a relationship that based on reluctant compromise between Mao and Stalin. So after Stalin died in 1953, and also after the Russian suppressions of the Hungarian uprising in 1956, we began to see the ideological differences or the political differences between China and the Soviet Union began to emerge. And it is much more difficult for Beijing and for Moscow to reconcile their differences in the late 1950s. So what you have is, you know, the relationship just break down, and the Soviet Union withdraw all their technicians, withdraw all their aids from China. And from the late 1950, from the 1960 onward, China began to adopt a much more anti-Soviet, slogan, much more anti-Soviet rhetoric in its foreign policy. Now, during that time, you know, at the time of the breakdown of the Sino-Soviet relationship, China also did not have a seat in the United Nations. Okay, at that time, the Republic of China in Taiwan was recognized by the international community as, you know, the government of China. So basically, Beijing was facing a serious crisis of diplomatic isolation. What Mao really wanted to do at that moment was, you know, he wanted to create a new coalition of radical forces called the Third World, because, you know, he realized that if he can't get any support from the socialist camp, he need to find a new political platform for him. And the best way to do that is actually to work with all these newly independent countries in Asia, Latin America, and Africa. So this new foreign policy is best captured in a Chinese political slogan during the Cultural Revolution, which reads like this: All people of the world united to overthrow the American imperialism, to overthrow the Soviet revisionism, and also to overthrow the reactionary of the world. Okay, it was one of those typical Chinese slogans of the Cultural Revolution, but I think that actually captured the kind of mindset, you know, that kind of, you know, mindset that, you know, China is being surrounded, you know, by the Soviet camp, the American camp, and she need to find a way out in order to gain legitimacy and also diplomatic recognition. So to Mao, and also to most of the communist leaders in Beijing, the Third World actually represents a land of opportunity, because the old colonial order had just collapsed, and also the new political system has not yet been established. So China decided to move in order to get to unify the third world country for its own political agenda. And during that time, sometime in September 1945, Lin Biao, Marshal Lin Biao, the head of the Chinese military, he also, made this statement as well, in the form of a slogan. He said, the United States and Western Europe are the city of the world, while as Asia, Latin America, and Africa, they were the countryside of the world. Now, within the Chinese communist mindset, it was always the countryside that actually won the revolution. The countryside surround the city, and then they run the revolutions of 1949. So by using the same rhetoric in its foreign policy, the subtext is Africa, Asia, and Latin America can actually form a united front against the USS, against the US and the Soviet Union. And it was against this background that China began to appeal to many third world countries, especially in the late 1960s and also during the 1970s. So what Beijing did was, they basically provide military aid to all the local revolutionary and liberation movement across the African subcontinent. And they also organized many international conferences for many third world intellectual and third world writer. So during that moment, I think during this decade of political radicalism in the 60s and 70s, so many third world countries began to look up into China as an icon, as a symbol, as a champion of the struggle against racism and colonialism. And I think Mao suddenly become a very popular star, a very popular icon in many African Americans writing in the US and also in many other leftist writings across the third world country. So everyone actually hijacked Mao. They actually used Mao to justify their own internal resistance against injustice within their own country. Now the thing is, how successful was Mao's policy towards the third world? Now, when we look back, it was not very successful at all, for very practical reason. Mao's third world policy actually failed to mobilize all these developing countries to come behind the China to fight against the US and the Soviet Union. Most of the third world leaders, they said in public they admire Mao's achievement in socialist revolution, land reform, and all kinds of socialist policy, but they don't want to face they don't want to run the risk of offending two superpowers, okay, the U.S. and also the Soviet Union at that time. So during the Cold War, China was basically a middle power, a middle state. It did not have the military and the economic resources to pursue global leadership, okay, especially in relations to the US and the Soviet Union. And also during that time, China also encountered military threat from the Soviet Union and the US. The war between Vietnam and the United States, the Vietnam War, it actually created a sense of insecurity along the Chinese southwestern frontier. And also the outbreak of the border conflict between China and the Soviet Union in 1968, it actually created a sense of insecurity in the mind of the Chinese leader in Beijing. So as a result, we can see Mao's third world policy was not very successful. Okay, it looks very impressive in rhetoric. Okay, it was a very convincing political slogan for all the young radicals and liberator or revolutionary around the world, but it did not create a new diplomatic mechanism against the American and the Soviet Union influence in global politics. So what China was doing during the Mao's period, she was basically responding to the problem of diplomatic isolation imposed by the West, okay, rather than during the third world country per se. Okay? So when China developed its third world policy, it actually had a much larger international agenda in mind. Okay? Now, after Mao died, we have Deng Xiaoping who took over, and I think Deng Xiaoping actually introduced a totally different policy, economic reform, which is totally different from Mao's revolutionary radicalism. Now, during that time, Deng Xiaoping and also the Chinese leader in Beijing, I think they make it. I think they make a number of powerful political statements. They said China would not oppose China would not interfere in another country's internal affairs. China will basically, you know, remain neutral in all the international and regional conflict. But the funny thing is, the overall directions of China's foreign policy during the Deng Xiaoping's era has completely changed. China actually adopted a much more pro-Western foreign policy. China actually gave many financial incentives to many international companies, to Western merchants and overseas Chinese, in order to encourage them to go to China to invest. And I think the Chinese government was also very eager to join many international organizations like the IMF, the World Bank, the World Health Organization, and also the World Trade Organization in order to attract, you know, foreign investment. During that time, China also sent large numbers of students to receive technical training from North America, Europe, rather than sending all these young men and young women to work in the third world. So throughout the 1980s and 1990s, Beijing actually became a stronger supporter of the U.S. diplomatic policy around the world. The main reason is, you know, Beijing just want to maintain a stable relationship with Washington and also trying to maximize all the potential economic benefit for its own economic reform. So in Deng Xiaoping's China, the concerns for economic reform was much more important than pursuing any new diplomatic alliances with the third world. Now, during that time, well, Deng Xiaoping, he died in 1997, and his successors, Jiang Zemin, he basically continued the same economic reform policy, and he also continued the same pro-American or the pro-US foreign policy. So when we look at China's relationship with the third world country during the reform period, China was very pragmatic. China only expand its diplomatic relationship with some middle power in the third world, such as South Africa, Mexico, and Brazil. The main reason is not to unify all these countries to fight against any common enemy. The main purpose is actually trying to marginalize Taiwan in global politics and also trying to use this country to stop Taiwan from joining the World Trade Organization, the World Health Organization, the United Nations, and also other international bodies. So during the reform period, the Taiwan question was actually one of the driving forces behind China's policy towards the third world. Now, everything actually changed dramatically after the War on Terror, after the September 11 incident. Now, the War on Terror actually transformed the global opinion towards the United States as an international power. And what is more important is, I think, in the War on Terror, the U.S. actually have great difficulty in fighting several war at the same time, and also the U.S. also have great difficulty in stopping all these nuclear weaponry programs in North Korea and Iran. So all this, so the military failure in the Islamic world, the diplomatic failure over the North Korean and also the Iranian nuclear crisis, it actually undermined the U.S. influence on a global scale. And also from the War on Terror, we also realized that the military power of the U.S. is freely spread around the world. Okay, so the U.S. government have problem of fighting several war at once and also pursuing its policy of global dominance. It was during that moment that China began to reposition herself to try to fill the power vacuum left by the United States, especially in Latin America, Central Asia, and also Africa. So it is against this background that we are going to see how China trying to expand its economic, cultural, diplomatic, and military relationship with many third world countries over the last 10 years. Now, what I'm going to do now is trying to use a regional approach. I'm trying to look at, you know, five different regions and try to see how China and the United States interact with each other in the following five regions. The first place is Central Asia. Okay, Central Asia. The second region is Southeast Asia. The third one is the Indian subcontinent, which is actually trying to look at China's relationship with India and Pakistan. And the fourth one is Africa, you know, to see how Africa become a new frontier for China. And the last region is actually Latin America. Yeah. five regions, Latin America. So the first region, basically to look at, you know, the Chinese expansion into Central Asia. Now, when I use the term expansion, I don't use the term within the framework, you know, I don't use the term expansion in terms of the 19th century European colonial expansion, which is always trying to go somewhere else and then trying to establish a colony or trying to take control of some kind of territory. When I use the term expansion, basically I mean the extensions of the Chinese economic, diplomatic, and sometimes even military influences. So let us look at what happened in Central Asia. Now, the new political climate after September 11, it actually created an opportunity for China to play a much more active role in Central Asia. It is against this background that we actually see a new political new diplomatic organization called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Okay. We began to see this organization, it actually play a very active role in connecting China, Russia, and all the Central Asian states since September 11. Now, this organization was initially established in 1996 between China, Russia, and also a number of Central Asian states. At the beginning, China, Russia, and all the Central Asia states like Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, they just want to create this organization to enhance trading relationship between them and also trying to contain the Islamic independent movement, you know, within their common territory. So at the beginning, they just, you know, use this organization to justify their campaign against the Islamic movement within their own territory. But the thing is, after September 11, we actually see this organization develop a much more active military and political agenda within the wider context of Central Asia. What happened was, you know, when the U.S. began its war on terror in Afghanistan, so for the first time, the U.S. actually established a formal military presence in the heart of the Asian continent. Okay? And suddenly China, Russia, and all the Central Asian Republic, they actually want to use this organization to counter against the growing American influence within Afghanistan and also in the Central Asian region. So what happened was since 2002, we have three military exercises that has been conducted by China, Russia, and the Central Asian state. In 2002, in August 2005, and also in August 2007, almost every 2 years, you know, all these countries, especially China and Russia, they will organize a large-scale regional military exercise in order to demonstrate their power, you know, to the outside world. And the most recent one, the military exercise in August 2007, it actually coincided with President Putin's decision to start the bombing patrol over Atlantic, Pacific, and also the Arctic Ocean. Now, what happened in the summer of 2007, the NATO, I think the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, they decided to expand their membership by including many Eastern European states and also many former Soviet Baltic states. Okay? They basically just create a buffer zone that actually surround Russia from the European fund. So in response, President Putin actually want to use this organization to launch military exercise in order to counter what Washington is doing on the European frontier. So it's a very interesting thing to see how these two international power trying to balance against each other in Central Asia and also in continental Europe at the same time. Now, through this organization, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, China and Russia actually established a formal defense alliance, a united front against the U.S. in Central Asia. And also during the time of the North Korean nuclear crisis, China, we also rely on the same organization to put diplomatic pressure on the United States. So if we look at the map, if we try to take a much more global perspective,
with this organization in Central Asia, so whenever China, the United States, they were negotiating with each other over the North Korean crisis, China, Russia, they can always use this organization to bargain with the United States over how are we going to deal with North Korea, especially over the North Korean crisis. So this Central Asian issue, this Central Asian security, also have an impact on the ongoing North Korean nuclear crisis that is actually happening. And I'm going to get back to that when I talk about Northeast Asia. Now, when we look at the Chinese expansion into Central Asia, apart from this, you know, strategic agenda, apart from this, you know, military consideration, there was also a very practical issue, which is actually the demand for oil and also the demand for natural gas. Now, in recent decades, you know, over the last, you know, several decades, you know, China has become totally dependent on the Middle East for its oil supply. Okay. In fact, I think China is now the second largest oil consumer in the world, and she actually received over, you know, 50% of its oil from the Middle East. And the International Energy Agency in Washington D.C. they predict that by from 2003 to 2010, from 2003 to 2000 to 2030, in the next 30 years, the world's oil demand will increase by another 50%. And I think this dramatic increase has to do with the China and also the economic development in China and also in India. Now the thing is, when we look at this, you know, huge demand for oil, you know, within China, we have to take into account two major issues. Now, within China, they have just began to create their own strategic oil reserve in 2005. And this strategic oil reserve is expected to be completed by 2010. Okay? So, and this oil reserve is trying to provide China with 2 months' oil supply at the current level of oil consumption. Okay, so if there's an oil embargo, if there's any serious crisis actually affecting the oil supply in China, the Chinese energy can only last for 2 months. Okay, so in a way, before 2010, China is still very vulnerable to the changes of the oil price caused by the military crisis in the Middle East, just like every country around the world. Okay, so that's the first issue. China do not have its own oil reserve that can actually allow her to, you know, survive a serious oil crisis. The second issue, China did not have an ocean navy, a strong ocean navy to protect her oil tanker that actually traveling from the Middle East to the Indian Ocean and then to the South China Sea. And China is still dependent on the U.S. China is still relying on the U.S. Navy to protect and also to ensure the security of its oil supplies across you know, the Middle East to the Indian Ocean. So the only way for China to do now is actually to diversify its energy supply and also trying to push for the creations of a multilateral political system in the world. So it is in this context that China adopt a much more aggressive policy to go to Central Asia and trying to get a new surprise, especially oil and natural gases, for her own economic development. Excuse me. So what happened? So over the last 10 years, when we look at Central Asia just become another form of the Silk Road. Okay, the traditional Silk Road that actually connect China, Central Asia, and India. But this time, this Silk Road, the main item that is actually on sale is not silk. It's actually oil and natural gas. For example, in 2004, China and Kazakhstan, one of the major oil-producing power in Central Asia, they agreed to build an oil pipeline to export oil and natural gas into the western part of China. And also in the summer of 2005, the Chinese natural petroleum company, they also went into Kazakhstan and took over the second largest oil company in Kazakhstan. And the idea is, you know, China would like to use its economic resources to get into most of the oil field and also natural gas resources across the Central Asia. Now, when we look at the Chinese expansion into Central Asia, it actually had a significant impact on the local economy, the local society in the western part of China, especially in the Muslim area called Xinjiang. Over the last few years, I have been taking my student to visit the Silk Road and especially the Xinjiang area. We noticed that most of the public bus and also most of the highway, there were tons of natural gas stations. Okay, so the natural gas actually becoming a much more a very important energy in Xinjiang, especially along the highway for transportation and also in most of the major city. So there seems to be a strong determination on the Chinese side to diversify its energy supply system, especially in the Muslim area. And we also see there was a growing economic and social linkage between China and her Central Asian neighbors in everyday life across Xinjiang. In cities like Urumqi, the capital, and also in most of, the bordering city, we often see many hundreds or thousands of travelers from Russia, Central Asia, Persia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Okay, they just came to Xinjiang to do business, to visit some of the Islamic religious sites, or just to be student and visiting scholar. So Beijing has been very successful in using its Muslim frontier to reach out to the Islamic world in Central Asia. Also, the local radio station, the Xinjiang People's Radio, which is a state-controlled radio station, it began broadcasting program in English for countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, and all the Central Asian states. The purpose is actually to counter the spread of Western idea from the BBC and the Voice of America, and also trying to present China as a land of opportunity for many young people in Central Asia, in the region. So whatever China is doing in relations to Central Asia is actually based on a wide range of factors. Okay, the strategic concern. Okay, how is she going to deal with the growing U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, the oil security, the energy security. And the third element is actually to create, to reposition China as a land of opportunity for all the young men and young women across the Islamic world. So imagining if you happen to be one of those young students living in some of this Central Asian country and you are seeing the war that is actually unfolding in Afghanistan and also in part of the Islamic world. Suddenly you encounter China as a rising market. And also as a rising economic power. So how would these young people pursue their career, in relations to China? It would be interesting to see the kind of social and also the kind of human connection between the western part of China and also most of the Central Asian state. Now, the second region that I want to look at is actually the Southeast Asia. Okay, Southeast Asia. Now, in Southeast Asia, we also see China adopt a very active policies of undermining the U.S. economic and social influence across the Southeast Asia mainland and also the Southeast Asia maritime world. Now, whenever we talk about Southeast Asia, we have to divide it into two different levels. The Southeast Asia mainland, all the major countries, and also all the major islands, across the South China Sea. Now, in 2005, Beijing actually encouraged the creation of an East Asian community. By definition, this East Asian community is a large regional alliance that actually includes China, Southeast Asia, Japan, South Korea, India, Australia, and New Zealand. Taiwan is actually the only major regional economy that was excluded from the East Asia community. But in the meantime, Beijing also provides But Beijing actually offer many economic package, for the Taiwanese businessmen and also for the Taiwanese farmer. It actually allowed them to export their products into the mainland. But anyway, when we look at the Chinese, you know, policy towards Southeast Asia, we see Chinese government is eager to create a win-win situation for all her neighbors, because, you know, throughout the 1990s, most of the Southeast Asian states, they expressed their concern about the growing Chinese military threat. Okay, countries like Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, they all complain about the growing Chinese military power across the South China Sea. So by creating this economic union, China is actually trying to work towards to create a regional model of economic integration. Now, this development actually reminds us the long history of internal trade that has been going on across the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean. Okay, all this, you know, maritime trade between China, the old Middle Kingdom, and the Indian merchant and the Arabian merchant, long before the arrival of the British, the French, the Dutch, and the American in the 19th century. So for most of this country across Southeast Asia, they actually had a long history of associating with the Middle Kingdom because of the economic benefit that they can get from the maritime trade. Now, whatever is going to happen, whether this development will help to create a China-centered economic union in the same format of the European Union, we don't know. And whether the Chinese influence will decline when its economic reform began to slow down and when the Chinese market lost its appeal to the Southeast Asian state. I think all these things are still uncertain, are still debatable. But we actually see Beijing has demonstrated strong determination to create a new economic order in the Southeast Asian maritime world by proposing this East Asia community. So in Central Asia, by using the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, we see a very ambitious continental expansion. In Southeast Asia, we see China trying to use East Asia community to achieve a maritime expansion. Okay, all these two things are actually happening around the same time. Actually, there may be one interesting story. I guess most of you heard about the name called a Chinese traveler called Jing He. Jing He. I think, you know, sometime in the 15th or 14th century, I think he actually, you know, sent by the Chinese imperial government to travel across Southeast Asia to the Islamic world and also to North Africa. Okay, so I think for many Chinese, they always see him as a symbol of world traveler, as a symbol of international explorer before Columbus, before the European went to the new world. Now, I remember 2 years ago or 3 years ago, yes, 3 years ago in 2005, there was a huge celebration about Jing He's voyage to Southeast Asia across the whole region. In China, in Shanghai, they have their own celebration. They portray Jing He as a symbol of the new China. Okay, what China is doing now is, you know, we are just going back to the old age of Jing He, a peaceful rise. Okay, so it's a very interesting way of using history to justify the current expansion. Now, the funny thing is, during that year, in the summer of 2005, I actually went to a number of conferences in mainland China, in Southeast Asia. In Southeast Asia, I came across a different representations of Jing He. In Malaysia, they also have their own celebrations of Jing He. It was actually organized by the Malaysian government, the Chinese government, and also the local Chinese community. They portray Jing He, they emphasize Jing He as a Muslim. Okay, he's a Muslim government official, a Muslim traveler. You know, as a Muslim, he tried to create friendship between the Islamic world in Southeast Asia and China, and mainland China. Now, in Singapore, they also have their own celebration. Now, Singapore did not exist in Jing He's time. But in Singapore, the government actually, you know, point out that, you know, Jing He might stop over Singapore during on his way to Southeast Asia and to Africa. And they basically want to emphasize that, you know, Singapore was actually the center of the Jing He travel. But Singapore did not talk about the Islamic background of Jing He, okay, because that can be very sensitive. It did not talk about Jing He when on a Chinese diplomatic mission. It basically just emphasized the importance of Singapore in all this international trading network. So the funny thing is, you know, in the summer of 2005, everyone was celebrating Jing He. Everyone hijacked him but they were talking about all different things. Okay, but the funny thing is the fact that they were able to rewrite Jing He, it was actually against the background of the China's rise. Okay, because China is rising, so everyone want to use part of its old history to justify the new economic, cultural, and diplomatic relationship with Beijing. Okay, from Central Asia and from Southeast Asia, now I move into Northeast Asia, which is actually to look at the whole North Korean nuclear crisis and see how China actually used the North Korean nuclear crisis to counter against the U.S., to balance against the U.S. Now, the interesting thing about the North Korean crisis is for China, I think the interesting thing about the North Korean crisis is China has been very active in the whole Six Nation nuclear talk. Now, the Six Nation nuclear talk actually include the United States, China, Russia, Japan, North and South Korea. Okay, all these countries that actually have direct interest in the North Korean nuclear program or nuclear crisis. Now, China has to support North Korea in the six-party nuclear talk because of its necessity to defend its frontier against the U.S., especially against the U.S. military in Japan and South Korea. The other reason is China also have to support North Korea because China did not want to encounter a refugees crisis on its north, you know, northern frontier. If the North Korean state collapse, basically there will be a huge, you know, there will be a huge refugees crisis, and I think China have to deal with that. So China want to avoid that. China basically want to sustain the North Korean state and try to maintain the status quo. Now, in early October 2006, North Korea actually conduct its first nuclear test, which actually undermined the American dominance in Northeast Asia. The test actually proved that North Korea now have the ability to produce nuclear weapons. And the question for the United States now is not how to prevent, but how to contain, and also how to limit this nuclear North Korea. Now, on the following date of the North Korean nuclear test, Condoleezza Rice, he actually, you know, made a public statement. He said, you know, the United States will not attack or invade North Korea, but what the U.S. will do is, you know, U.S. will continue to put economic pressure on North Korea and just want to make sure the North Korean state will not share its nuclear technology with another country. So the implication is there's nothing that Washington can do to stop North Korea from developing its nuclear weaponry program. But for the Bush government refused to have any direct negotiation with North Korea. What the U.S. want to do is, you know, still the U.S. want to use the six-party nuclear talk. Basically, the U.S. want to use China, Russia, Japan, and South Korea to put pressure to isolate North Korea, and basically still want to use this international mechanism to contain North Korea. Just a week after the North Korean nuclear test, the United Nations actually passed a resolution called the Resolution 1718. The resolution actually urged all the countries to intensify their diplomatic effort with North Korea. Basically, nothing serious. Okay, just get back to the negotiation table and just to keep on talking, to keep on negotiating. At the same time, the resolution also imposed some, you know, economic sanction on North Korea, but still, not many other countries have a direct economic and diplomatic relationship with the North Korean state. Only China was the major trading partner of the North Korean state. So everyone actually look up to China and see how China can prevent the North Korean state from conducting a second nuclear test. Every country actually look at China and see how China can force the North Korean back to the negotiation table. Now, after the United Nations passed the UN Resolution 1718, the North Korean representative in the UN, it actually accused the United Nations Security Council as a gangster organization, and they even threatened that Pyongyang will test their second bomb. Now, it was during that moment that Beijing began to take a very dramatic action. You know, the Beijing government actually sent a high-level delegation to Pyongyang to negotiate with the North Korean leader. And also China during that time, it also tightened. It also It also imposed a cargo inspection between China and the North Korean state. And also China even threatened to cut off its oil supplies to the North Korean state. So whatever China was doing during that time was to keep the North Korean and the American at the negotiation table and also trying to stop the escalation of the crisis. And that Chinese policy actually worked. It actually forced the United States, North Korea, to sit down and talk. It also forced all these countries to start the new a new round of the Six Nation nuclear talk. It also gave a face-saving opportunity for North Korea and China and the United States to get out from this nuclear mess, nuclear crisis. Now, when we look at the whole North Korean nuclear incident, the North Korean state actually had a very clear agenda. Basically, the first one is to end the military tension, the military confrontation with the United States by ending the Korean War. Okay, so what the North Korean leader has been saying is they want to use the nuclear weapon as a bargaining chip, okay, to get the U.S. to agree to sign a treaty to end the Korean War. Okay, the Korean War that we have in 1950 to 1953, it ended in 53 without signing a peace treaty. Okay, there was a ceasefire between all the major parties. But technically, the United States and the North and South Korea, they're still at war with each other. So for the North Korean state, they want to sign a formal agreement with the U.S. to end the conflict. And also the of course, I think the U.S., the U.S. government, did not want to have any formal treaty with the North because I think the U.S. want to continue to justify its military presence in Northeast Asia in order to contain China and North Korea. So it was in this kind of diplomatic deadlock that the U.S. and North Korea cannot agree with one another. So the nuclear crisis actually create a new opportunity for the North Korean state and the Washington government to sit down and also trying to start to renegotiate the term of ending the Korean War. Now, the Chinese positions on the North Korea was basically very clear. It was purely for defensive purposes. China want to limit any escalations of violence and confrontation in Northeast Asia, because if there's another new round of North Korean conflict, it's going to affect China's economic program, especially her economic development. And also through the Six Nation nuclear talk, China actually becoming a winner. Okay, China emerged as an equal power with the United States, because after all, everyone saw that it was China who managed to force the North Korean to the negotiation table. And also, China also wanted to use the North Korean crisis to negotiate with the United States over the Taiwan question. Because at the time of the six-party nuclear talk, we actually see the Chinese Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they has been making a very strong public statement against the U.S. support for Taiwan's military modernization, and it was through some kind of backdoor negotiation that we began to see that the Washington D.C. began to back down from arming Taiwan, from supporting Taiwan's plan for independence. And it was through this kind of exchange of interests that we actually see China and the United States, they actually connect the North Korean crisis and the Taiwan question together. So when we look at the Sino-American relations, whatever happened in North Korea negotiation will always have an impact on the negotiation between China and the United States over Taiwan. Okay, let me move on very quickly to India and to see how China and the United States interact with each other over the South Asian subcontinent. Now, when we look at the relationship between China, India, and Pakistan, it was basically a relationship characterized by border conflict and also strategic competition. In fact, most of the time, China and India, I think they has been a strategic rival. They have been a strategic competitor, okay, in the Himalaya mountainous region. The main reason was I think China rejects the British dual border between India and Tibet, and also India also support Dalai Lama to create an exile government in India after the Tibetan uprising of 1959. And also China and India, they also fought against each other over a series of border conflicts in the 1960s. So in terms of the relationship, you know, China and India was actually a competitor throughout the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And because of this strategic competition, China also went all the way to support Pakistan in order to use Pakistan to subdue India, in order to use Pakistan to limit the influence of India within the South Asian continent. Okay? So to the political leaders in India, if you look at the map, for the political leader in India, when they look to the east, you know, they encounter China. When they look to the west, they encounter Pakistan. So to the political leader in India, they actually see it is a two-front threat. Okay? It's a two-front threat that actually they have to deal with in their international diplomacy. Now, the funny thing is, China never abandoned its strategic relationship with Pakistan. Because I think for China, she realized that if she wants to contain India in the south of Himalayas, if China wants to contain India and to stop India from becoming a regional power, China needs to sustain Pakistan and also trying to use Pakistan to prevent the rise of India. So historically, we actually see there was a close military and diplomatic relationship between China and Pakistan against India. Now, for India, they also derive a number of counter strategy in order to overcome this Chinese influence. What India did was, okay, your friend's friends is always your enemy's friends is always your friends. Okay, your enemy's enemies is always your friends. Okay, so I'm confused. Okay, I think for India, she basically just, you know, went through the Indian Ocean to establish a strong diplomatic and also military alliance with the Philippines, Vietnam, and Japan and Taiwan in order to counter against the Chinese influence over the Himalaya regions. Now, It was only in recent year, in 2004, we began to see the high-level discussion between Beijing and New Delhi over their border conflicts. In 2004, China and India, they basically sit down together and they decided to cooperate and also trying to expand their economic and diplomatic ties. Okay, they sit down and talk and they actually recognize each other's border. Okay, that means for the Indian case, they actually recognize Chinese control over Tibet, while as for the Chinese case, they also recognize the Indian border or the Indian control over a number of Himalayan mountainous kingdom. And also at the same time, China also recognized, you know, the Indian's nuclear weaponry program. The same thing, the U.S. also recognized the Indian's nuclear weaponry program in 2006. Now, what we see here is, while China and India, they were trying to create a much more harmonious relationship across the border, the United States began to come in, the U.S. becoming a new factor that actually affect the balance of power between China, India, and Pakistan over the South Asian subcontinent. We settled the border conflict so that each country can actually concentrate on their modernization program. And also in the meantime, these two regional powers, they also want to recognize each other in order to accommodate the rising U.S. military influence in Central Asia. So in a way, we began to see an informal diplomatic alliance between China and India encounter against the U.S. in Afghanistan and Central Asia, and especially over the whole conflict over Iran. okay, you know, there has been some discussion about the U.S., you know, taking a military action against the nuclear weaponry program in Iran. But whenever this debate was being, whenever this, you know, military action or proposal is, you know, put on, is being discussed, we actually see the reaction from Beijing and from New Delhi was extremely critical. Okay, so in a way, we actually see, you know, China and India seems to be on the same side over the whole Iranian problem. Okay, they basically want to bring the U.S. to the negotiation table with the people in Iran and also trying to avoid any escalations of conflict in the Asian heartland, you know, especially in Central Asia. Now, in terms of the business partnership, both China and India were actually very aggressive in expanding into Africa because both countries need resources, okay? You know, they went together to countries like Sudan, Angola, and also Nigeria to open up the local oil field and also to look for new raw materials. But by comparison, I think China seems to have outperformed India in getting access to all the raw material, the rich resources across the African continent. So Africa is the next region that I'm going to talk about. Africa has become a new frontier for Chinese expansion. And I think the major issue behind the Chinese presence in Africa is actually oil, a raw material. China had always seen Africa as a major supplier of oil and all kinds of resources. But at the same time, they also see Africa as a modest consumer. So most of the time, we actually see the Chinese state actually invest tons of money in several African states in order to open up its oil field, okay, for the Chinese consumption. The best example is Angola and Sudan. Okay, Sudan is actually Africa's second largest oil producer. And nowadays, Sudan is actually, especially in 2007, just last year, Angola actually suppressed Saudi Arabia and become the largest oil supplier to China. It actually produced almost 20% of China's total oil import. Okay, and also in Angola, the Chinese enterprise are also the largest foreign business investors in the country. So, the oil-producing country like Angola is now becoming one of the top priority of China's foreign policy in Africa. The second country is Sudan. I think we often heard about, you know, the report of the human rights abuse in Darfur, in the western part of Sudan. But when we look at the oil development in Sudan, the Chinese company actually was the leading player in the oil industry in Sudan. I think they have been investing $4 billion to $6 billion over the last few years in developing the oil industry in Sudan. And the Chinese government has also been supplying arms, weapons, and military equipment to the Sudanese government in order to make them, well, basically trying to get them to win the civil war in order to ensure a continuity of Chinese access to the oil resources in that country. If we look at, President Hu Jintao's travel schedule, you know, he has been to Africa at least once or twice a year, okay, since 2001. So basically, Africa now is becoming a top priority in China's foreign policy. There's also one interesting thing, though. When we look at the Chinese expansion into Africa, apart from this high-level talk over oil industry or some other raw material, we actually see a large number of students, African students, African government official, technician, scientists, they actually has received their training, educational training, professional training in China throughout the 1990s and also since 2000. In fact, from 2000 and to 2006, over the last 6 years, we have as many as 10,000 African students and government officials who went into China at different period to receive their professional training. And most of these returning professionals, they actually become the agents of China's expansion into Africa. So maybe for any one of you who are looking for research project, that might be one interesting topic to look at actually. You know, just to see how this human interaction, the social and cultural interaction, how this cultural interaction actually facilitate the Chinese economic and political expansions into the African continent. Okay, finally, let me just move on very quickly to look at the Chinese expansion into Latin America. Now, historically, Latin America was always a fear of a natural fear of influence of the U.S. Okay, historically, Latin America is basically America's back garden. Okay, no one can touch it. That has been the case since the beginning of the 20th century. Okay, now, since 19th century. I think Latin America has always, you know, relied on America, rely on the United States as their primary patron. But since the War on Terror, since the beginning of the War on Terror, we began to see Washington, D.C., they began to cut down all their military aid and economic aid to the Latin American state. And during that moment, China actually increased its aid to Latin America. Okay, so many Latin American state, many Latin American government, they began to intensify their economic relationship with Beijing. So there has been some concern in Washington about the fact that whether Latin America will one day replace the United States with China as their major patron. For example, maybe some interesting statistic, from 1993 to 2003, just in that 10-year period, the Chinese Latin American trade actually increased over 600%. Okay, if you look at the real number, the real figure, in 2004, the trade between China and Latin America overall was about $40 billion. This figure actually overtook Japan's trade with Latin America. So China is now becoming the third largest trading partner with the Latin American continent. And when we look at the Chinese investment in Latin America, most of the Chinese investment actually concentrate on the development of infrastructure, especially highway, railroad, okay, in countries like Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Peru, and Mexico, all the major countries in South America. In fact, there has been a discussion of creating a cross Latin American highway from Brazil to Peru. The purpose is China and the Brazilian and the Peru government, they want to create some kind of, you know, transportation network that actually allow the merchant to transport their product from Brazil to Peru, and then from the harbor in Peru to ship everything across the Pacific Ocean to mainland China. So this growth of trans-Pacific trade between China and Latin America actually had an important impact in reorienting the Latin Americans' focus towards East Asia. Maybe sooner or later, we will actually see Latin America, China becoming the major trading partner for the whole South American continent. Now, besides the economic relationship, we also see a growing military cooperation between China and many Latin American countries. A good example is China is reported to have been running two intelligence stations out of Cuba since 2000. I think the purpose of this, you know, intelligence station is to monitor the computer traffic within the U.S. And also in 2001 and 2002, China is said to have been negotiating with Russia for using some of the Soviet military facility in Cuba to do the same intelligence gather intelligence information from the U.S. And China also take advantage of the vacuum created by the War on Terror. For example, China has been inviting many senior Latin American military officers to Beijing, basically by, you know, giving them all kinds of military aid, weaponry program, and also economic incentive in order to buy the support and loyalty of a new generation of the Latin America military officers. So when we look at all this transformation, you know, how China counter against the U.S., you know, in different parts of the world, basically two conclusions. One is a new international system is still in the making. Okay, basically we see China has been very aggressive in filling all the vacuum left by the United States in Africa, Latin America, South Asia. And Washington DC also trying to compete with Beijing over some of the regional dominance. For example, in North Korea and also in Iran. Okay, so a new global system is still in the making. What we see today in terms of the U.S.-China relationship is a very intensive balance of power. The second thing is, when we look at China's third world policy, it actually reminds me of Mao's ideas of guerrilla warfare. Basically, you know, before you occupy the country, you're basically trying to build up all your military strength in the countryside, and then you use the countryside to surround the city, and sooner or later you will win the communist revolution. So that was the logic of Mao's guerrilla warfare. And I noticed that right now, when we look at China's federal policy, the leader seems to be following the same Mao's logic. They try to actually establish a close diplomatic relationship across the third world. And maybe sooner or later they are going to create a new diplomatic system like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the East Asia Community, or the Six-Party Nuclear Talk. You know, basically a new diplomatic framework to surround the United States and also the European Union. So maybe Mao is still relevant. Okay, so maybe Mao is still relevant in terms of formulating one's military and diplomatic policy. Yeah. So even though the leader, they reject Mao, and they all just, you know, forget about Marx, and they all, you know, decided to embrace capitalism, but when you look at their foreign policy, they still have to, you know, read the little red book and try to get some ideas. Okay, I think I should end here, so maybe we can have a Q&A section.